Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Richard Rubin, Vice Chair of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, and I'm your chair for today's program. Today's program is part of the club's series on ethics and accountability by the Charles Travers family. We thank them very much. And now it will be my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Larry Kramer, who is president of the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation and a noted constitutional law scholar. He will be discussing how to eliminate political gridlock in Washington, and related to that, a recently launched project of the Hewlett Foundation known as the Madison Initiative. A few words about Larry Kramer. As I indicated, he's the president of the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, which is in Menlo Park, and he has led it since 2012, before joining the foundation. Mr. Kramer was for 8 years the Richard E. Lang Professor of Law and Dean of the Stanford Law School. His teaching and scholarly interests includes American legal history, constitutional law, federalism, separation of powers, the federal courts, conflict of laws, and civil procedure. Early in his career, Mr. Kramer served as professor of law at the University of Chicago and the Michigan Law Schools. Prior to that, he served on New York University's law faculty. Mr. Kramer did his undergraduate studies at Brown University, where he graduated magna cum laude, and then went on to the University of Chicago Law School, where again he graduated magna cum laude in 1984. He has written numerous articles and books, including one entitled The People Themselves, Popular Constitutionalism and Judicial Review. Please give a very, very hearty welcome to Larry Kramer.
Thank you. Let me just clean this up a bit. Anybody want a gavel? Now, I do have some slides for those of you who are listening out there. I'm going to try not to refer to them, but for you here, I may mess this up because I actually have only used slides once before in my life. So let's see how it goes. I want to start with a couple of historical observations. This is actually a condensed version of a much longer talk on the underpinnings and background of the constitutional values that I actually want to spend some time on. So I'm going to summarize a great deal of information in a few brief minutes. I'm happy to elaborate after if any of you doubt or are unclear about what I'm going to say. So first, one of the most remarkable aspects of the American Revolution was the way in which it created an American identity that did not exist before in the short space of a very few years. There was no such identity as late as, say, the 1750s, as Ben Franklin discovered, much to his dismay, when he tried to get the colonists to work together against the French and Indians in the Seven Years' War, and that was in 1754. The colonists saw themselves as citizens of their colonies and of the British Empire. But there was not yet a distinct American identity, and a colonial Virginian had no more reason to identify with his counterparts in New York or New Hampshire than in Bermuda, Barbados, or Newfoundland. New British policies adopted in the 1760s changed all that, giving the colonies, for the first time, reason to unite. And as they did unite, a process began whereby colonials who had felt immense pride till then in being English began to reconstitute their identities, abandoning their Britishness and, for the first time, becoming Americans. Now, that was not anything they set out to do. They initially sought only to create a political union in order to push back against England and, after independence was achieved, to protect themselves from the European powers. But along the way, intentionally or not, they did manage to forge a new identity. Yehoshua Arieli has argued, and I think this is right, that the United States offers the first example in history where political self-determination preceded and to a large extent drove the process of national identification and the creation of a national identity. People who didn't see themselves as a people formed a government, and having done so, only then became one, became, that is, we the people of the United States. As remarkable, the development of this identity took place with astonishing rapidity in the early years of the Republic. By the time the War of 1812 ended, the disparate British colonies of the 1760s, which literally were virtually foreign nations to each other, had completed a profound transformation in the way they perceived themselves and the world around them. Tocqueville marveled at this, describing to a friend the puzzle that would frame his analysis of America. Picture to yourself, this is Tocqueville, picture to yourself, if you can, a society which comprises all the nations of the world, people differing from one another in language, in beliefs, in opinions. In a word, a society possessing no roots, no memories, no prejudices, no routine, no common ideas, no national character, yet with a happiness 100 times greater than our own. This, then, is our starting point. What is the connecting element between these so different elements? How are they welded into one people? The answer, as Tocqueville well understood, is that Americans built a new identity on and around two related cornerstones. First, their commitment to an idea, the idea of republicanism that motivated the revolution. And second, a system they devised themselves to make that idea a practical reality in day-to-day governance, the U.S. Constitution. These became the foundation for expressing who we are as a people and what unites us as a nation. The phenomena that defined and still today define America and Americans uniquely in the world and in world history. Lest you doubt it, I invite you to visit the National Archives. I don't know how many of you have ever been to the National Archives, but if you go, you'll see the Declaration and the Constitution laid out literally as on an altar. As clear a display as you could make of the one true religion, albeit a civic religion, that all Americans actually share. We may indeed share nothing else and still be Americans. We can worship different gods or no god. We can eat different foods, enjoy different activities, read different books, want different things for ourselves and our children. But what we all share in common is our commitment to this system of republicanism and constitutional government. This indeed is what it means to be an American. But if acceptance and commitment to our republican constitution defines what it means to be an American, then we need to ask, what does the Constitution stand for? Or more accurately, what does it require of us? Now, each of you will have answers to that question. Most of them, I suspect, pointing toward values like equality and free speech, due process, privacy, property rights, and the like, all of which are unquestionably important. Although it's interesting to note how most of the typical answers tend to come from the later enacted Bill of Rights as opposed to the Constitution itself. In any event, I'm thinking of something different, because at its heart, our Constitution is about realizing and implementing democratic self-government, republicanism. And the question we really need to ask is, what does the Constitution require of us to make that work? And the answer, interestingly enough, is not something typically highlighted or even mentioned in most discussions of our constitutional system. Yet it is essential, a set of core values, perhaps the core values, needed to make republicanism work. I mean a willingness to deliberate, to negotiate, and ultimately to compromise with others who disagree. This, I want to suggest, is a fundamental obligation and responsibility of both citizens and their representatives in government, or perhaps I should say both representatives in government and citizens, a necessary condition for republican rule and one of the central principles on which our constitutional system rests. Now, that claim may come as a surprise or sound strange to some, because while deliberation has always attracted attention among people who debate the Constitution, hardly anyone highlights or draws specific attention to negotiation and compromise as constitutional values at all, much less core ones. Yet this was the heart of the constitutional system our founders devised, the essential tool they decided was necessary in order to make popular government work. It was a lesson learned the hard way. For in the first flush of excitement that accompanied the Declaration, the new states adopted constitutions that put their faith, and so most government authority, in powerful legislatures. And they did so in an optimistic belief that the republican virtue of the citizenry and its elected representatives would be sufficient to ensure good government. The results were not pretty. And by the mid-1780s, many Americans had begun to see that something more or different was needed to create a functional popular government, a government that could, as James Madison later wrote in Federalist 10, secure the public good and private rights, and at the same time preserve the spirit and the form of popular government. Now, fully describing Madison's and the other founders' theory of the Constitution is actually a separate talk in and of itself. Happy to come give that sometime if you want. For now, suffice it to say that the chief objective was to create a process that would ensure the kind of deliberation needed for, again, as Madison put it, the reason of the society to overcome the tendency of self-interested factions to abuse or oppress others or government authority. To do this, of course, good leadership was essential, and virtuous leaders could, in theory, prevent factions and factious majorities from acting badly. But in practice, we know, as Madison said, that enlightened statesmen will not always be at the helm. I missed my first slide. That's Madison. Added safeguards were needed to blunt the process of majority formation, to slow it down long enough for the country to have a proper public debate. And among the surest of these additional safeguards was simply to make the republic larger. Again, quoting Madison, extend the sphere, and you take in a greater variety of parties and interests. You make it less probable that a majority of the whole will have a common motive to invade the rights of other citizens, or if such a common motive exists, it will be more difficult for all who feel it to discover their own strength and to act in unison with one another. The difficulty of forming such majorities would, in turn, create time and space for the kind of public deliberation and discussion that's necessary to refine popular opinion and help it coalesce around a just and reasonable decision. So this is familiar stuff to people who've studied the Federalist or the Constitution, but note how this description of the effect of enlarging the republic differs from the usual understanding of Madison's famous argument. The usual assumption is that because Madison feared that legislators would be too responsive to majorities, he wanted to prevent majorities from forming, thereby leaving officials free to craft solutions that satisfied some independent and objective notion of the public good. But in fact, Madison was committed to the idea of majority rule. He said over and over again that the essential principle of republican government was that the majority rules, as did everybody else in the period. And they believed in the sovereignty of public opinion, understood as the opinion of the majority. Madison's actual concern was more focused. It wasn't majorities that he feared. It was unreflective, factious majorities, the kind of majorities that he thought could be formed all too easily and all too quickly, for instance, at the state level. The benefit of extensive size was that by making it more difficult for majorities to form, a large republic gave reasoned argument and opportunity to prevail, so that whatever coalition of a majority of the whole eventually formed, quote, could seldom take place on any other principles than that of justice and the general good. Okay, at the risk of oversimplifying a little, you can characterize the process that Madison envisioned as a kind of conversation, a conversation in which elected officials deliberate collectively and lead by persuasion an electorate actively engaged in making its own judgments and decisions. But the nature of the conversation was unique. It wouldn't involve representatives mechanically pushing for their constituents and engaging in a process of horse trading and log rolling. The obligation of leadership was to enlarge and refine those views, to filter and improve and take into consideration the different views of others and bring those back to constituents. But neither did Madison envision this conversation as some kind of idealized debating society or philosopher's club. Madison understood that how people saw the public good would differ depending on who they were, where they were from, and who they were accountable to. How people saw the public good, in other words, would inevitably be shaped by their situations and by their interests. The whole point of extending the republic, then, was to encompass people from a wider variety of situations, and so take in a greater number of interests. And the resulting diversity of viewpoints would both slow down and improve the process of majority formation, precisely because it would require a complex process of negotiation and compromise, the same process Madison had witnessed in Philadelphia when they wrote the Constitution in the first place, except somewhat more complicated because members of Congress couldn't work in secret and would need to include and inform constituents in the ongoing deliberations, something Madison spoke about at great length and frequently. Nor was size the only device our Constitution used to ensure discussion and deliberation. The risk that enlightened statesmen wouldn't always be at the helm required, in addition, that power be divided. As Madison explained in Federalist 51, first between two distinct governments, the state and national governments, and then the portion allotted to each of those governments subdivided among distinct and separate departments. All these different branches and departments of government could then use their powers to impede actions by the others if they objected, thus forcing the kind of public debate needed for the reason of the society to emerge and coalesce. Structural innovations in the form of federalism and separation of powers then became the final elements of our Constitution's design, a means of further ensuring a process of public deliberation, negotiation, and eventually compromise to advance the cause of republican liberty. Which brings me to my main point, that the lawmaking process envisioned by our Constitution could work, was intended to work, only if participants understood and acknowledged that they were part of an extensive republic, comprised of people whose views about the public good would necessarily differ, and were willing to contribute in good faith to the inevitable process of deliberation, negotiation, and compromise needed to secure that good, while at the same time preserving the spirit and the form of popular government. The process of deliberation, negotiation, and compromise, both inside Congress and within the larger political society, is desirable. It's the heart of what Madison affirmed with pride at the end of Federalist 10 is a republican remedy for the diseases most incident to republican government. I love that quote, but note the emphasis should be on the first republican, a republican remedy, as opposed to where most attention is placed, which is to the diseases most incident to republican government. Yes, there were diseases, and yet here was a republican remedy. Which brings me to today, because we seem to be losing sight of the importance of these core values as critical features of our constitutional system. Worse, we seem increasingly to be turning what are essential values in republican government into dirty words. This is a long-term trend that began in the 1970s, but has been accelerating in recent years. In an almost comical interview when he first became speaker in 2009, John Boehner literally refused to say the word compromise, conceding only that he would seek common ground with opponents while insisting that he would not change positions on anything. Yet he was recently challenged as speaker, an almost unheard of event, because he's seen by many in his party as too accommodating. Today we have candidates for office, lots of them, campaigning on explicit pledges never to work with the other side, or candidates including a powerful majority leader in the House defeated because they were willing to consider looking for common ground. Matt Kibbe, CEO of FreedomWorks and a leader of the Tea Party, said, and this apparently without irony, that not compromising is the glue that holds us together as a social movement. But the problem extends well beyond the Tea Party. In the run-up to the most recent midterm election, the Washington Post published a column entitled "Compromise is a Dirty Word" that concluded, based on polling data, that compromise is a political loser. And when John Dingell was asked, in connection with his retirement after 57 years in Congress, what the biggest changes were, he replied, lack of collegiality, refusal to compromise, and absolute reluctance to work together. A research assistant helping find material for this speech wrote me that if digital content had any weight, there would be literally a ton of material on compromise being a dirty word. Such assertions are, sadly, supported by quantitative evidence. Sarah Binder, a leading scholar on Congress, constructed a measure of gridlock based on the number of issues left unresolved in a given term relative to the number of issues that are actually salient. She found that gridlock has been rising for several decades and that the 112th and 113th Congresses were the most gridlocked ever. That being so, it's no surprise to learn that Congress has also become notably less productive. Less than a tenth of 1% of bills last year became laws, the fewest since before World War II and the emergence of the modern administrative state. Now, I'm aware that passing a lot of laws doesn't equate with effectiveness, but surely a drop of that magnitude suggests that something has gone wrong, particularly when measured against the output of other second-term presidents in divided governments. In 1997, when Bill Clinton was president, Congress enacted 153 laws. During Reagan's second term in 1985, Congress enacted 240 laws. Even in the midst of the Watergate scandal in 1973, Congress managed to enact 247 laws. Compare those figures to last year's paltry 72 laws, and you see the problem. Historians have already awarded the 113th Congress the title of worst ever in the modern era, adding that the only real competitor is the 112th. That verdict is clearly shared by the public, whose disdain is expressed in Congress's record low poll numbers, which I should say were never particularly high, but have now managed to reach depths that no public institution had ever reached before. Okay, blame for Congress's decline is usually placed on a steady and, in recent years, steep increase in political polarization. Political scientists, this is the technical part here, political scientists define polarization in terms of two interrelated phenomena. First, political parties move farther apart on policy, the Liberal Party moving to the left as the Conservative Party shifts rightward. This is, you see up the way Congress looked in the mid-80s. So, Liberal Party moves left, Conservative Party moves right. Second, the range of views within each party becomes narrower, each of the bimodal peaks having a higher median and a smaller spread. Thus defined, political polarization is at an all-time high. Party line voting in particular has never been more prevalent. Last year, majorities of the two parties differed with each other on 7 of every 10 roll call votes, the highest in at least 6 decades. More telling, both houses of Congress set records for the number of instances in which 90% of one party voted against 90% of the other party. Generally speaking, members in both houses exhibit far more party discipline than in the past. As late as the 1970s, the typical member of Congress voted with his or her party just over 60% of the time. That increased to 70% in the 1980s, to 80% in the 1990s, and in the 2000s has risen to an astonishing 87%. There's been an ongoing debate about whether this polarization is asymmetric, whether, as Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein have claimed, it's mostly the fault of Republicans. The conclusion of those who hold the view that it's mostly the fault of Republicans is chiefly based on so-called DW nominate scores, which is, that's what's up there. DW nominate scores measure ideology and roll call votes on a two-dimensional spatial model, and they do indeed appear to show more movement on the right. Other recent scholarship, however, points out that the DW nominate scores don't accurately depict ideological movement over time, and there's a lot of other evidence to suggest that both parties have moved in roughly equal measure. Both have certainly moved in any event. So like it or not, Democrats and Republicans must share the blame for congressional gridlock and inaction. That conclusion is actually further supported by survey evidence, like a recent one from Pew Research Center finding that while Democrats are more willing to say they favor compromise, in practice they're actually no more likely than Republicans to in fact support it. There's also evidence that on average, neither liberals nor conservatives have changed their positions very much. Liberals are not particularly more liberal today than they were in the past, nor are conservatives, in fact, all that much more conservative. Rather, what's happened is that liberals and conservatives have become better sorted ideologically, with conservatives confined to one party and liberals to the other. That change, which shows up clearly in the roll call votes in Congress, would account for both of the developments that political scientists interpret as polarization, both what looks to be moving farther apart and what looks to be a narrowing of positions. Be all that as it may, I think it's a mistake to blame the decline of compromise on political polarization, to assume that polarization increased and as a result, compromise has suffered. If anything, the opposite is more accurate. Decreased willingness to negotiate and compromise is the behavior that defines political polarization. So let me explain briefly why I say this, and then I'll turn to why it matters. So why do I say this? First, because while it's undoubtedly true that people who are farther apart ideologically find it harder to compromise, the willingness to compromise actually stands independent of substantive ideology. That is to say, someone who's disinclined to compromise will be disinclined to compromise whether the other side is ideologically close or distant. Just as someone who believes believes in achieving compromise may be as willing to compromise with people whose position differ greatly as with those who are ideologically closer. In the language of economics, the likelihood of compromise is a product of the legislator's reservation prices, which are a product of attitudes independent of their ideal price. The literature on polarization is written as if legislators only ever voted their ideal price. They have a position, that's it, they're just going to stick to it. Or as if the reservation price is how far they're willing to deviate from that position in order to achieve a result, as if it's always very close to their ideal price. On that view, you just need to plot where members of Congress stand on a left-to-right continuum and assume that everyone simply votes that position, and if the middle disappears, the legislature will grind to a halt. In fact, the results we see may be a product of decreased interest in or willingness to compromise, rather than increasing distance between liberals and conservatives. But then you may ask, why do the DW nominate depictions of roll call votes look as if the parties are drifting farther apart while becoming narrower within? Because the DW nominate scores in most of the measures that are used to tell us where candidates stand ideologically assign members an ideological position based on how they actually vote, based on what they do, in other words, rather than what they might want to do. Suppose, for instance, that I'm a centrist Democrat, but either as a matter of party loyalty or to preserve my position within the party, I always support the party's leadership, which is more liberal than me. In that case, my DW nominate score will portray me as ideologically identical to party leadership, even though I'm not. It follows that the polarization that appears may reflect, and this is what I think it chiefly reflects, little more than a decreased willingness to compromise with the other party. Polarization is the outcome, in other words, not the cause, the outcome of reduced willingness to meet the other side somewhere in the middle. That conclusion is consistent with the data on sorting I described earlier. The left isn't farther left, nor is the right farther right. Instead, there's less disposition in each party to compromise, a result of changes in party composition and party competition, not the result of an increase in polarization in Congress as a whole. So what explains the reduced disposition to compromise? I don't think you can account for it by saying that officials won't compromise with others whose ideology is different. After all, back when there were conservative Democrats, they usually supported their more liberal party members. And the same was true for liberal and conservative Republicans. Not on all issues, of course. Passage of the civil rights laws, for instance, depended on an alliance of liberal and moderates in both parties against conservatives in both parties. But issues like that were closer to the exception than the rule. And party alignment overcame ideological disagreement more often than not, as we saw 60% of the time back in the 1960s and 70s. Yet today, there's no willingness to compromise even on the small matters. So something beyond ideology must account for the change. Polarization, now understood as decreased willingness to compromise across party lines, is a byproduct of two reinforcing changes in the parties. One, the sorting that has made each party more ideologically monochromatic. And two, a significant uptick in party discipline, or the willingness of members to vote the party line even if they disagree or would be willing to moderate their position. The former change, sorting, has robbed people who differ ideologically of the best incentive they used to have to compromise, which was being a member of the same party. While the latter change, party discipline, has made it harder to compromise even in the absence of an ideological driver. This is what Mann and Ornstein mean when they talk about the most significant development in American politics being the emergence of parliamentary-style parties in a separation of power system. Party discipline now trumps willingness to accommodate opponents a lot more than it used to. Now, accounting for these changes in party composition and competition is not difficult. The sorting of parties into more clearly defined liberal and conservative camps, that has many causes, but chief among them is probably the dynamic that was created by passage of the Civil Rights Act and Richard Nixon's Southern strategy in 1968. White Southern Democrats had not necessarily shared their party's views since the New Deal, but reflexive, leftover Civil War resentment against Republicans had kept them in the fold. Abolishing Jim Crow and securing voting rights to African Americans proved too much, and Nixon took advantage of that, along with growing resentment over social issues touching on sexual and family values. And so began the process of turning the solid Democratic South into the solid Republican one. As the Republican Party became more conservative, liberal Republicans were induced to make the opposite shift, finding a more agreeable and hospitable home with the Democrats. In the meantime, a whole variety of other developments have enhanced party discipline, further narrowing room for compromise already reduced by ideological sorting. In no particular order, these developments include such things as changes in Congress's internal operations that centralized power and strengthened leadership at the expense of committees and committee chairs. These include a wide range of rule changes that have taken place over many years. Includes the abandonment of regular order and various other shifts that curb the ability of individual members to break ranks. Negotiation and compromise across party lines have likewise been inhibited by massive growth in organized external networks of so-called intense policy demanders. That would be interests that really care about particular policies. So these are organized interests that are now dependably associated with one party or the other, such as Democrats and unions or the Republicans and evangelicals, interests that are able to pressure party leaders and disrupt potential compromises before they can even be formulated. Campaign finance reform has played a major part in this development. By weakening the role of parties in financing elections, well-meaning but ultimately misguided reforms, going all the way back to the 70s, enhanced the power of these intense policy demanders, who now use their financial leverage, which is not outbalanced on the other side by anything, to reward supporters and punish the unfaithful, particularly, of course, in primary elections. Room to act independently of the party has been further hampered by the simultaneous development of what is aptly called the outrage industry, partisan media that punish anyone imprudent enough to deviate from the party line and that give a platform and a powerful public voice to the party's most doctrinaire elements. The most important cause, however, may simply be that Americans are genuinely and closely divided on issues. As a result, and even taking gerrymandering into account, the effect of which, I should say, is greatly exaggerated, every election has the realistic potential to shift control in one or both houses of Congress. Consider that Democrats held the House for all but four of the 62 years between 1933 and 1995, and held the Senate for all but those same 4 years between 1933 and 1981. Since the 1980s, in contrast, the Senate has turned over five times and the House three times, and the opportunity to win control in one or both of the chambers has usually been within reach. The potential to gain or lose control every 2 years has in turn given rise to a so-called permanent campaign, a permanent campaign mentality that keeps the partisan temperature at a constant boil. When every action is fraught, undertaken as if in the middle of a hotly contested election, it's no surprise that teamsmanship within the parties and hyper-partisan posturing are at a premium. I love that alliteration. Hyper-partisan posturing are at a premium. And that compromise and moderation suffer. Now, that brief list of causes, and it is brief, is hardly exhaustive. A wide variety of institutional and cultural developments have further contributed to or exacerbated the problem. Things like a shortened work week combined with reluctance to live in Washington, which has undermined cross-party personal relationships. The point, in any event, is that a combination of factors has contributed to a profound shift in political culture, in which it is now increasingly difficult to compromise, in which paying more than lip service to the idea of compromise is increasingly devalued, and indeed in which the need even to pay lip service is fast waning. Still more worrisome, these developments, which in fact began at the federal level and in Congress, are now metastasizing out to the state and local levels, and worst of all, into the general public. Why that matters should be evident from what I said at the beginning. The American constitutional system is built on an idea of negotiation and compromise among people who will always have different passions, interests, and beliefs. If embrace of our constitutional system is what it means to be an American, and embrace of negotiation and compromise is an essential part of what it means to embrace that system, then the repudiation of compromise as a value is a repudiation of our core identity as Americans. I'm loath to use a term like un-American, given the sorry history of that charge. But if the accusation were to be made against anyone, it would be those who repudiate the value and importance of compromising. They are the ones denying the essence of what defines our democracy. Now, let me hasten to add that I'm absolutely not saying that there are no matters of principle on which we should not compromise. Of course there are, slavery being the most obvious example from American history, although it is a complicated one. But God save us from the people for whom every issue and every disagreement is a matter of high principle equivalent to opposition to slavery in the 19th century. It is simply preposterous to treat the difference between a 36% and a 39% marginal tax rate as if it were the choice between socialism and oligarchy. Just as it is idiotic to describe the modest Affordable Care Act as tantamount to slavery, or Paul Ryan's proposal for premium support under Medicare is equivalent to telling the elderly to eat cake. It's a matter of political culture, of attitudes and expectations. There is a world of difference between assuming that we can and should compromise over our differences, subject to rare exceptions for matters of particular import, and shunning compromise unless an existential crisis is at hand. Hard choices will always need to be made, but our attitude in approaching them should be one of respect for disagreement and openness to accommodation. We should be able to disagree about policy without labeling our political opponents illegitimate or refusing to work with them on any terms short of their capitulation. If we cannot do that, cannot restore the ability of elected officials to reach sensible accommodations around such differences, cannot make and get behind the critical decisions needed to govern a complex society and economy in a post-industrial world, it's not clear that our constitutional system has much of a future. It was with that in mind that the Hewlett Foundation last year launched what we are calling, for reasons that should be obvious from what I've said till now, the Madison Initiative. That's Congress and scaffolding. It's an effort to repair national politics by mobilizing support for changes that can bring the spirit of negotiation and compromise back into Congress, and through that, we hope, to the larger political society. I'll not go into the details here. You can find a description of the initiative on the Hewlett Foundation website. As you'll see if you do look, though, it's short on details because we're still feeling our way around the problem, which is immensely complex, and trying to identify what might make a difference. We are, however, as an initial matter, tentatively exploring three areas that we think can, especially taken in conjunction, make a difference in how Congress operates. First, and they're not the usual ones, at least the ones you hear about most in the media and from the pundits. First, we're looking at rules and norms inside Congress that can be changed in ways that foster agreement across party lines. These include everything from re-strengthening committee chairs to restoring regular order, especially in the budget process. Filibuster reform, you do hear that one a lot. Restoring practices like bipartisan factual briefings. The parties used to get briefed on the issues around proposed legislation together. Now they each have their own briefing, so the two different parties are getting completely different facts. Finding a way to build personal relationships across party lines is important, and so on. Second, primary elections and nominating caucuses are critically important moments, often as or more important than the general election, because they reduce the field of choice to two. Yet only a tiny portion of citizens actually participate in these events, as few as 7 to 10% of voters in primaries and even fewer in caucuses. Those voters tend, moreover, to be the most activist and ideologically extreme, which is why elected candidates from both sides are consistently and considerably more ideologically polarized than the general electorate. We are accordingly looking for ways to increase voter turnout and or otherwise structure primaries to mitigate the problem, but the key is to get voter turnout up. Third, strong, professional political parties tend to be moderating forces because the people in charge are usually mostly concerned with winning elections. And for most of American history, our parties were responsible for campaigns. Parties no longer play this role, and candidates today instead spend well over half their time trolling for dollars from the intense policy demanders who, among other things, punish them for compromising. Hence, we're exploring whether there are ways to re-strengthen the role of parties in campaign finance, while also looking for ways to free candidates from needing to devote so much of their time to raising money. In addition to these central efforts, we're looking at other changes that might help make a difference, such as enriching media coverage of Congress and politics, or improving election administration in ways that could rebuild public confidence that change for the better is even possible. What's most important is that the effort be truly nonpartisan. The foundation we have policy goals in our other programs, but achieving or even advancing those goals is not the purpose of this one. I'm from Chicago, and I might root for the Cubs. I don't actually root for the Cubs. That's a long story. Well, if you grew up when I did, you know, how many times can you be disappointed? All right, but assume I rooted for the Cubs because I'm from Chicago, while you root for the Giants because you're all from San Francisco. When we play each other, we each really want our respective team to win and beat the other side. But we are both presumably capable of understanding that developing the best rules for the game is different. and that the game is not helped by trying to warp those rules to make it more likely that my team or your team will win when we play, especially since what favors my team today may favor yours tomorrow. Equally important is undertaking this sort of work with realistic expectations and an appropriate sense of modesty. The Hewlett Foundation is not going to single-handedly save America's democracy. We do hope we can find a few areas in which to intervene, where we can help nudge the system in a better direction. But we know that we can't accomplish even that much alone, and that we'll need allies from the funder and activist communities, and from the left, the right, and the center, just as we know that even if we succeed in our immediate efforts, ultimate success will depend on factors bigger than us and outside our control. Foundations can sometimes help reform or change institutions, but political reforms are notoriously easy to thwart or distort, depending on how the background political culture receives them. Institutional changes can affect that culture, but it's a two-way street, and our ability, anybody's ability for that matter, self-consciously to move culture is limited at best. Even viewing the odds of success as long, we decided to undertake the effort because the stakes are so high. I don't mean to sound melodramatic, but we should not assume that the American Republic is permanent and cannot fail. If history teaches us anything, it's that all human institutions can fail. In the end, as with everything in a Republican system, responsibility for making things work rests with and depends on the people themselves. The foundation will try to do some things that we hope will begin to rebuild public confidence, that change for the better is actually possible, relatively simple things, as I mentioned, like improving election administration. We also seek to be part of a movement to improve our nation's political processes and to restore a sense that successful compromises are something to celebrate. But in the final analysis, the American people must revitalize the political culture themselves. So let me finish with a very famous story about Ben Franklin. Upon learning that the Constitutional Convention had concluded its business, a crowd gathered outside the Pennsylvania State House, which is Independence Hall today, where the delegates had been meeting. As he left the building, a Mrs. Powell in the crowd asked Franklin what form of government the Constitution would create. A republic, Franklin replied, if you can keep it. Most of you, or many of you, have probably heard this story before. I remember feeling pride the first time I read it, which was many years ago. Pride in realizing how tenuous the American experiment was at its launch, and pride in thinking about how distant that fragility now seemed. It no longer seems distant to me, and it shouldn't to you either. Thank you.
Thank you to Larry Kramer, the president of the Hewlett Foundation, and thank you not only for the remarks, but I think based on the raft of questions and the hunger for this conversation, thank you for the initiative on behalf of the Hewlett Foundation. I want to start with a couple of quick questions just in reflection on a couple of your comments and then get to some very specific questions that the audience has. I think you very thoughtfully and rightly point out that this is not a guaranteed, this experiment is not guaranteed of success. It never has been. I wonder if you could take the long view for a minute and think about other challenges and indeed crises we've had in preserving the American Republic and how you would place our current issues with gridlock and inability to actually govern in relationship to some of those issues.
Yeah. Good question. So, you know, when I think about this, there are basically four prior moments in American history that I think you'd point to. The one that's closest to today, actually, I think is probably the 1790s. So the country virtually collapsed in its first decade. And that's true even though the Federalists, who were basically in control of the government, did a phenomenal job governing. I mean, they steered their way through really complex foreign problems. The economy was booming, and yet the country virtually came apart at the seams in the election of 1800, which was the, you know, the battle between, it ended up being Jefferson and Burr, who was Congress going to vote for. Hamilton, who was general of the army, moved the army towards Virginia, anticipating something. The governor in Pennsylvania mobilized the militia. I mean, they really were right to the edge of it. And what got us through that time was the formation of political parties. I mean, it was that kind of organization that could make people at the local level feel they had some connection to politics and help them understand what to expect and give them a way to feel they were a part of it. the Civil War is obviously the second one, and it did come apart. So, you know, now, the reason, what's interesting about the Civil War from my perspective first is that the thing that made it inevitable was the breakup of the Democratic Party in 1860. It was the one national unifying institution, and it split into North and South branches around the Lecompton Constitution in 1860. And at that point, the Civil War became inevitable because you didn't have, again, the institutional thing that would make this stuff work. And then it was the reformation of parties after the Civil War, which happened very quickly, that really made it possible to continue on. Third period, of course, is the Progressive Era, which looks the most like ours because there was the most polarization then. It's the only period that rivals this for polarization. But it's not as bad as it looks, because the truth was, in that period, there was actually pretty much complete agreement across the parties on policy issues. There wasn't that much, and it was all about patronage. So there was a lot of fighting, but there were no real stakes that tested the political system, except if you wanted a job. And then, of course, the fourth period is around the New Deal and the Great Depression. And again, events like that will always put pressure on the democratic society. There was something similar happening across the world. It really was the question of how to deal with, in this way, it's similar, right? Large accumulations of wealth, and can we redistribute when you have massive poverty and so on? And of course, you know, we got lucky. What's interesting to me, in some ways, we got lucky in all of those periods, right? Thank God George Washington and then Jefferson and Madison were around. And the Civil War, you know, Lincoln comes from nowhere, right? And then turns out to be just the right person for the job at the time. And same thing with Roosevelt and so on. So the point to me is, on the one hand, each of these incidents is unique. So there's nothing, except that they all share two qualities. One is that they don't repair themselves. Somebody has to push for the kinds of reforms that are necessary, which is why we're interested in doing this. Because a lot of people are like, see, all those things happen, and look, it worked out. It's like, yeah, well, it didn't work out because it just happened. There were people at the time, the progressives, you know, the people who formed the parties and so on. And then second is that it really depends on healthy political institutions. And that's really, to my mind, where a lot of the problem is. So a lot of it is, can we restore it's not that we're not democratic enough, and the solution isn't to make us more democratic. It's not to weaken the institutions within the government still more with some notion of greater direct democracy, right? It's the opposite. We need to strengthen the institutions that mediate politics for people. That was the original understanding and design, and that's where the solution has lain each time.
And do you take any lessons or comfort or encouragement from a few places where there has been dramatic compromise and change in recent years? For example, the sudden and rather dramatic advancement of gay rights and acceptance of gay relationships?
No. I want to. Every time it's like, although it's not so much that, it's more like there have been some, like, because that's not really a moment of compromise. That's a moment when public opinion is shifting. And where public opinion goes, when it goes in one place, government will always follow. As I say, that's why I said in the talk, a big part of the reason here is that truth is Americans are really divided on these issues. You know, we disagree with each other. And the problem is, how do we work across those disagreements? So it's not, there have been a few moments of compromise in recent years. And every time they happen, you think, oh, maybe now the fever is broken. And then now it gets even worse. And, you know, what's, I think, is kind of ironic, again, is, I didn't talk about this, but a lot of the things we have done in recent years, it seemed like good political reforms have been counterproductive. We got rid of earmarks, right? Everybody said, yes, earmarks, they're corruption. It's like, yes, you need a little corruption, just a little bit, right? At the cost of 0.1% of the budget, you grease the wheels for people to make deals that were much more important. We got rid of that small little expense. And we didn't even get rid of earmarks. We just shifted them from the legislature to the executive. They have to be made. But we did make it really, really much more difficult for people in Congress to compromise with each other. And look what we get. And the budget compromise, it's because it was filled with earmarks. They didn't call it earmarks, but that's what they did, because that works. And so it's, again, a lot of this is, we need to get away from a kind of idealized notion of democracy and just understand what a difficult profession it is, and be open to that.
Many of you know I'm Dr. Mary Marcy, and I'm the president of Dominican. I'm also a political scientist, and I think I could have this private conversation for a long time. But you have a lot of questions, so I want to get to your questions. A series of questions are actually about the party system itself. And one which I'm sure you've heard before, and I'm very interested in your response, is how much of the polarization is an artifact of having a two-party system. Should we think more seriously about a multi-party system, and how can we get more voices besides these polarized voices involved in a party process?
Yeah. So, of course, you know, historically, the two-party system has actually served as the chief and a phenomenal device for producing compromises. So, you know, there's no idealized party system. The truth is, you look around the world, there's all sorts of different party systems. You can have many parties, and then they can be very centralized, and things work pretty well. And that's when the sort of bargaining and the negotiations and the ins for voices take place through the different parties. You can have, as we have had, a relatively small number of parties, but then they were very decentralized and big umbrellas, and so that provided the same thing. So those compromises were taking place within the party. You effectively had parties within the party, although they weren't formally identified as such. If you get to like very few parties or like one party that's very centralized, you get tyranny. That's the Soviet Union. So, you know, you can, there's all sorts of possibilities. Where we've drifted now, of course, is we still have only two parties, but the discipline issues within the government and the weakening of the party institutions that were the places where the brokering took place for all these interests is our problem. So you could think about all sorts of solutions. My own view, speaking in terms of really getting something done, would be actually creating a third party in this country is immensely difficult for all sorts of reasons, historical, cultural, legal, right? There are laws that tons of laws you'd have to change just to really create space for third parties. So it makes more sense to work on reforming the two parties that we have and just restoring their ability to do what they've historically done.
And so much of when you were talking, it was I thought really important to note that you talk about gridlock and you talk about polarization, but you did not talk about partisanship in any conventional sense.
Right.
That the parties actually can and have compromised in the past. There are two somewhat related questions that I think are certainly on a lot of people's minds as far as the current environment, which is how much of the intransigence is due to the fact that we have a black president?
You said two questions?
Well, there's a related one about gender, so we'll do that one next.
You know, I don't know the answer to that. It's on the one hand, it's hard not to have the suspicion. On the other hand, it's really easy to make that the basis for explaining things. The Obama White House has lots of things that they have done difficultly and not well. Right. They really are bad at working with the members of Congress. And they're difficult to work with. He really has been removed. So, you know, is that somewhere in the mix? Maybe, certainly for some people, is it the explanation? No. I view this as this did not start with Obama's election by any stretch. What we've been witnessing is a kind of downward spiral that began really with Nixon. And, you know, from my perspective, what we've seen is where the executive goes is where the battle goes. So Nixon gets elected, and the Democrats under Nixon were actually worse than prior Congresses had been, right? Carter gets elected, and the Republicans are worse than the Democrats were under Nixon. Reagan gets elected, and the Democrats are worse than the Republicans were under Carter. Clinton gets elected, and the Republican... did I miss somebody in there? I missed somebody.
Bush,
Carter.
Bush the Elder.
Oh, yeah. Well, Reagan. Reagan, Bush. I'll count them as one. Clinton, the Republicans are worse. Bush, the second Bush gets elected, and the Democrats are way worse. And a lot of the tactics that these Republicans have pushed to the extreme were pioneered by the Democrats in those years. They were the ones who really pushed the filibuster, for instance. Not anywhere near as far as these Republicans, but it's been and I guarantee you, if the Republicans were to win the presidency, the Democrats in the next Congress would be terrible. So, you know, I look at that as a really dominant, everybody wants to outdo the guys before them because they're angry and they've seen what they did and got away with it. And, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and it does seem to work. And, you know, all sorts of reasons that downward spiral continues. And so it's been really bad with Obama, I think more accelerated. And there are probably lots of factors in that.
Well, the somewhat related question is, would it matter if a woman was president?
You know, I don't know. Same thing. I suppose it would depend on who the woman was. You know, Hillary's going to bring a lot of baggage, right?
You think?
Has nothing to do with her being a woman, as well as whatever baggage she brings for that reason. There are people, we have this discussion inside our program about, you know, there's a fair amount of decent social science literature that says, in general, women are more open to compromising, more open to negotiating, and so on. And so if we had more women in politics, we would see more of this. You know, my own view is maybe, but those are really big overlapping bell curves, and the forces that are preventing anybody from doing this are still going to operate, and we got to do something about those. You're not going to get a solution that way. And in the meantime, sort of making that the basis for a solution is itself going to be a polarizing issue. Mm-hmm. So it's a difficult route.
Yeah, the one small group that has had some statistical impact is the group of women in the Senate, and they are a group.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not a president, and with all of the forces that come in.
Yeah, but look how limited even, you know, yes, some, but it's still so marginal because the problem, the forces against us are so big, so you just have to take those things on.
Yes. There are a number of questions about different specific aspects that you mentioned that are influencing gridlock or encouraging gridlock. So I'm going to pick a few of those off and invite you to dig a little bit deeper in some of those areas. One is actually about not just the media, but technology in general, that the combination of online blogging and internet communication has completely changed the nature of our political discussion. Has it been for the better? Has it been for the worse? Can we use it to make it better? Is it only a negative influence?
It's a tool, so I think it has been for the better and for the worse. It just depends on which pieces of it you point to. A lot of great journalism has been enabled. A lot of really horrible, uncivil discussion has been enabled. I think it's a mistake to think of technology as the answer. But that's largely because, you know, my belief is people change technology more than technology will change people. So again, what's the source of the problem? The source of the problem is still out here with us. There are things I think that can be done. You know, the extent of the uncivilness that online debate enables because you're no longer face-to-face, right? I won't say things to you face-to-face that I might if you're some anonymous person who just angered me and I don't have any sense of you. We've been thinking about, are there ways to sort of dampen that down just by how you engineer web pages? For instance, a friend of mine showed me some research that if you require someone to put a picture of a person near a comment they put on, even if it's not them, they get more civil. Right? It's just the association with the person that does it. So you know, there must be things we can do to dampen down the problems and better capture the benefits, but it's not there are no silver bullets, and it's certainly not technology. Mm-hmm. Can I tell you one quick conversation I had? At one point we were exploring this issue, and I had a conversation with, you know, we invited in all the new tech, like these kids who've started all these new tech companies, you know. They all come in, they were all dressed the same. I mean, it was so ironic. They all had, you know, like jeans and hoodies, and they hadn't shaved in 3 days. And I was thinking, you know, it's like, it's a uniform. It's like they're just, and, you know, and so, and they all had this incredible idealistic belief that technology, and, you know, one of them said, but you look at this app. If a fire hydrant is buried in snow, you just put on there and all these people turn out and they dig it out. And I was like, yeah, that's great. That's how it starts, you know, but that's like the hippies, you know, it started out, it's all peace and love. And the people who first said it were all peace and love. And then it gets bigger when you attract more people. And the next thing you know, you got Charles Manson. And that's right. That's the way this stuff works, because people are people at the end of the day, and it itself is neutral. So,
and you get idealistic, and then you eliminate earmarks, and everything goes downhill from there.
Yes.
Part of my job is to remind our radio and internet audience that they are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California, and our guest is Larry Kramer, a constitutional law scholar and president of the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation. And we are discussing rather actively gridlock in Washington. Another series of questions, actually, so I will try and put them together a bit, are about where voters seem to be and where Congress seems to be. Aren't voters themselves more willing to compromise than the congressional people that they elect? And what is the role of the electorate in electing polarized representatives? Isn't the electorate getting more polarized too, or are we more willing to compromise as a population than the people that we
right.
elect?
Right. So first, we know that the empirical questions, which is the public at large is definitely more willing to compromise than the members in Congress. We also know that that's getting worse. And of course, that's because eventually people do follow leadership. So as the drumbeat out of central leadership remains the same, people get angry, and it just gets worse. So one of the reasons to intervene now is there's still lots of opportunity, but it's getting worse. And that's one of the things, if it gets bad enough, we're going to have a real issue. And then you say, well, if people are so willing to compromise, why doesn't it happen? And as I say, a lot of it is the structural issues that make it difficult. both in terms of what happens in Congress and who gets elected. So this is why we have such, at least at the moment, a big focus on primary elections. Because if I want to be elected into Congress, the first thing I have to do is win a primary. And that's going to require me to attract money and get votes from what is going to be the far wing of my party, whichever party I'm in. And unless I do that, I'm not going to get elected at all, right? And most of the reform, you know, it doesn't matter whether my district is competitive or not. The gerrymandering thing, it doesn't matter, right? Because as long as 7 to 10% or fewer are picking the candidates, the only difference between a competitive district and an uncompetitive one is whether in the general election I have to choose between an extreme Democrat and an extreme Republican, or whether it's just one or the other because that's who has the safe district there. So you have to get at that first part. And until we do that, you're not going to get candidates in Washington who are themselves going to be more eager and willing, even if the person elected wants to, would. I mean, you talk to most of the members of Congress, if you get them off on the side, they hate this. They don't like spending so much of their time trolling for dollars. They would love to be able to get some stuff done and be able to come home. They work on committees. They, in addition to being a Republican, if I'm on, say, the banking committee, I want to do something to make the banking system better, right? I can't. I can't because as soon as I do it, I'm going to be called out on Fox News or MSNBC. I'm going to have all this money come back against me. I'm going to have to go home in a primary election and face that small version, those small numbers of voters. Those are the things you have to get at. And until you do that, the vast majority of Americans more willing to compromise, but they're also kind of sitting in the middle. You know, they're not activists. They're not engaged. They're not voting in primaries. You know, and that's always been the case. Actually, for what it's worth, the Madisonian system, we want those people. We don't want, if everybody got actively engaged, they'd all polarize. That's what happens. You know, people who know too much are the ones who like feel too strongly. So we depend on a large mass of citizens who kind of have a pretty good sense of generally what they want, but are willing to defer to leadership in Congress, which is going to work this stuff out. And then the question is, well, how do we get that leadership into Congress? And these are the structural issues that we think are getting in the way.
And I can't believe that we only have time for one question, and we do, and there's a lot of other questions out there. No, you didn't, but you talked very well. So I'm going to ask one last question and try and capture at least what I could see as a common theme among a lot of folks, which is using your background as a constitutional scholar as well as the work that you're doing with the Madison Initiative, could you talk a little bit about the Citizens United ruling, the influence of... I saw numerous questions with references to different individuals, the Koch brothers and so on, are trying to influence elections. Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about what possibility there is for changing that part of the scenario?
Okay, so there's two parts to answering that question. So the first one, I have to be a little less certain than I would like, but a lot more certain than most of the people who talk about campaign finance. So we need to know a lot more than we actually do about the role and influence of money. There are a whole lot of assertions that are made that are not necessarily true. It's not clear, for instance, that all this money actually is having that much effect on outcomes. Conventional wisdom among most of the political scientists I talk to are that once you get above a certain threshold of spending, spending more doesn't much matter. And in most general elections, the candidates from both parties get above that threshold. Now, that doesn't mean that the pouring money in isn't a problem, because the candidates don't necessarily believe that, and it does distort what they do when they get to Washington. And as I said, we think the biggest effect in that direction is what's happening in the primary elections as opposed to the general election. So it's just worth keeping in mind that, you know, another way to get at this might be to actually persuade people that spending more isn't particularly that important, in which case you don't need to spend all your time trolling for dollars. Try it. See what happens. Nobody does, you know. So, but I don't know. I don't want to assert that too confidently. I just know that we need to know a lot more. In terms of the legal framework, you know, I mean, my constitutional law professor career was dedicated to the proposition that we have given the Supreme Court way, way, way too much authority, that's a mistake, and that we shouldn't treat their decisions as particularly final. There are various ways to push back and come back on what they do. Well, that is not a widely shared view, I hate to say it. The only candidate who ever took that position was Newt Gingrich in the last election, and he got hammered for it by everybody. So as long as we continue to sort of say the Supreme Court gets to tell us what our Constitution means, right, that we're a democracy except when it comes to the important stuff. When it comes to the important stuff, then we have to have this little mini monarchy over there of nine people who get to tell us what our rights are. But as long as that's the case, we're kind of stuck with the framework they've given us. Now, Citizens United is not an important case, not legally. It Because if you look, most of the spending isn't coming from corporations. It's still individuals. Its role as a case was really as a cultural signal that all bets are off. And so the amount of money getting spent took a big uptick after that, although it had been rising steadily. The real problems actually came earlier. And, you know, from Buckley v. Valeo forward. So it's really been the framework which says money is speech. I actually think that's probably right. But the second part, which says, and our free speech values are free market. So we can't have government regulation, whereas in most markets, if you're going to use that analogy, where there's a market imperfection, we allow government to step in and regulate. So you would say certain kinds of regulations ought to be permissible to restore a level playing field so that the speech opportunities are equal. But the court has said no, and the only way you're going to change that, as long as everybody believes in judicial supremacy, is, you know, wait for some of the justices to die or get tired of the job and hope that you can get a president who agrees with you to put people on there. And that's really what you're stuck with for the moment. That's why, again, we think it's more fruitful to look at what can be done, which is let's re-strengthen the moderating institutions and make them equal in the funding fight, which parties have always been. And so if we can do that, we're not going to solve the problem, but we can temper it, perhaps by weakening the relative strength of the intense policy demanders out at the edge who are using their money to pull everybody off to the sides.
I can't imagine a more important conversation to have in our society right now. I can't imagine a better place to do it than at the Commonwealth Club. And I can't imagine a better person to lead that discussion than Larry Kramer. So please thank him for this question. This program has been part of the club's series on ethics and accountability, generously underwritten in our thanks to the Charles Travers family. I'm Dr. Mary Marcy, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.